Good morning. I'm Veronica Rickert in this week for Kathleen Dunn, and happy to be with you here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This morning, we're talking about the global recession and why it may just be ushering in what our guest this morning is calling the death of macho, or the end of global male dominance. From societies becoming disenchanted with aggressive financial policies that favor men, to the rise in socioeconomic and political power for women, we may be standing on the threshold of a revolution. Our guest this morning is Rehan Salam. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the article The Death of Macho, which appears in July's Foreign Policy magazine. You can reach us this morning with your own thoughts at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, the call-in number, and our email is talk@wpr.org. Well, what do you think? Do you think Americans are tired of financial policies that favor men and that they blame men for getting us into the financial mess that has hit so hard? Is there a global backlash against men? I hope you'll call us and give us your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. And Rehan Salam, it's great to talk with you again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, your article is called The Death of Macho. Let's start there and tell us a little bit about what you mean by that.
Basically, there was a kind of economic regime built around the interests of men, and that regime is crumbling. And as to what exactly one means by macho, it varies depending on context. But broadly speaking, it's this idea that men ought to be the primary breadwinners, that their identity is bound up with their economic role as breadwinners, and that women would have a secondary role in economic terms.
Well, can you lay out some of the evidence that you see that the recession and its mirror images globally is hitting men in a way that's more than just a blip on the radar?
Well, there is a gap in the unemployment rate between women and men. Women have now become almost 50% of the labor force, and they're on track to become a majority of the labor force in the United States. And also, their unemployment rate is in the neighborhood of 8%, whereas that for men is about 10%. But there's also a bigger structural change. If you look at labor force participation rates, they've almost doubled for women since the late 1940s to the present, whereas for men, they've actually gone down pretty dramatically from the mid-80s to the mid-70s. And there's reason to believe that that trend might actually continue with fewer men participating in the labor force. You have that phenomenon of dropouts from the mainstream economy, and you also have, in educational terms, a situation in which women have rapidly rising rates of educational attainment, whereas men have been stagnant and even falling behind in some respects.
What do you think is, what's behind that, that women are going to be the ones walking away with more college degrees than men?
It's hard to say exactly what's behind that. I mean, part of it could be this perception on the part of many men that it's a raw deal, that, you know, they can finish high school, yet it won't fundamentally be that valuable to them, though that's actually very wrong. It is very valuable to them. But also you see a situation where in co-educational schools, boys start developing pretty serious problems around 12, 13. We've heard a lot, rightly, about discrimination faced by women in educational terms, yet one of the good things about the last couple of decades is that it's really ebbed to some extent. You see women and girls performing better, for example, in math by the time they get to secondary school. That was something that hadn't been true a little while ago. And so you see lots of women, you know, kind of flourishing in those terms. But you see a lot of men, again, in that critical age around middle school, starting to falter pretty severely. And for a lot of these guys, they don't end up catching up later on. And that's going to have lasting consequences.
Well, you also make a pretty strong case that men are being blamed for the financial problems, the recession, in terms of at least some of the bubbles. You look at how the decisions that were made were maybe more aggressive decisions than women would have made, and also the decisions that were made favored industries that were dominated by men. Do you think that's how most of the world sees it, that there is something maybe, you know, Y chromosome related that caused this?
That's tough to say. I mean, I don't think that you even have to get into whether or not it's somehow, you know, genetic or something like that. It's just that, you know, you have gender roles that are pretty robust, and men tend to be overconfident. meaning that, you know, even in terms of financial risk taking, they tend to be more aggressive than women. And there are definitely upsides to that, but there are also downsides. And I think that, you know, you have this moment when you're looking at the compensation structures of the big financial houses in which, people saw a lot of the upside risk, but they didn't see a lot of the downside risk when it comes to compensation. And so I think that encouraged this kind of culture of extreme risk-taking. And I think that there is definitely a backlash against that.
The risk-taking or against men?
Yeah, against risk-taking. Against risk-taking, the kind of risk-taking that men are particularly prone to engage in.
There have been other reads on what happened there, and some of that is that there just wasn't the institutional memory from generation to generation to see the warning signs as they came up. And men haven't been particularly singled out, you know, because of gender in that respect. I mean, what makes you think that people are specifically angry at men and see that these aggressive policies as stemming from men?
Well, I think that, you know, you certainly see that in the rhetoric in Iceland and Latvia. And I think that here, it's speculative necessarily. There's no rigorous way to capture this, whether or not there's anger towards men per se. We don't have polling data saying that, America, and also, presumably men are not going to be angry at men, right? So as long as they're, 48, 49% of the population, then that's going to be a natural kind of upper bound. The question is, are people more likely to turn to women to serve as leaders in corporate organizations and also in political organizations? And I think the answer is yes, though, of course, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, we'll see in 10 years if you see more women in leadership roles, and I'm pretty sure we will.
Well, it's interesting because the recession, the meltdown, happened before the in large part, at least, before the presidential election, and that yielded us not Hillary Clinton as a candidate, but Barack Obama, who won.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that also, a lot of Senator Clinton supporters, then-Senator Clinton, I should say, believe that there was pretty intense misogyny directed against her, and all kinds of arguments that had been deployed not necessarily intentionally many saw as pretty sexist. And I think that, if you re-ran that election now, what would be the outcome? And my guess is that, given the fact that we're now, in the thick of a global economic crisis, that Hillary Clinton's argument that experience counts I think might have actually led to a very different outcome. And I think similarly on the Republican side, it's not obvious to me that John McCain would have won the primaries if you had been in this economic climate then. I think that it was just a different world. And I think that that explains to some degree the political outcome. On the other hand, it's also true that Barack Obama was very effective at reaching out to women. As you know, there's a gender gap in support for the two political parties, and the Democrats have pretty outsized support among women, whereas Republicans have outsized support among men. And, Barack Obama was able to blunt Hillary Clinton's advantage among women pretty effectively by speaking out to what are classically seen as, women's political concerns. I think that's a little unfair, by the way. But when you look at the stimulus package that President Obama was selling, there's a very heavy emphasis on health and education spending, and those are sectors in which women predominate. Whereas if you look at China, for example, their stimulus package was almost exclusively oriented toward infrastructure spending, and that's an area that, will generate jobs for less skilled men. So it's an interesting contrast.
Well, you see this sort of end of mantra, as you call it, coming up globally elsewhere, maybe with more obvious results. You talked about Iceland and Lithuania. Tell us about those two cases.
Well, Iceland is a particularly interesting case because it's a country that has suffered massively from the economic crisis. When we were talking about this risk-taking zeal on the part of men, I mean, Iceland was an extreme manifestation of this, a small, very affluent country, the economy of which was primarily based around fishing, and technology relating to fishing made a big foray into high finance. And that ended up blowing up in their face. And it was something that was really engineered by this male-dominated government. And then you had them tossed out by a left-wing coalition of the Social Democrats and the Green Party. And this coalition, wants to radically change the way Iceland does business. They've just applied to enter the European Union, for example, which is, a bit odd for a country that has, tried to go it alone for literally hundreds of years. They've also called for a just general rebalancing of economic priorities, and you see just a general cultural backlash against men that, kind of came to a head during the political campaign. So I think that, you know, that, again, is a very extreme manifestation because the crisis has hit Iceland even harder than it's hit the United States, much harder than it's hit the United States. And also, you know, but I think that, you know, they also already had, you know, kind of more women who are ready to take leadership positions in a way than we do, than we're kind of a little unlucky in that regard. But I think that, you know, if this crisis deepens, if it accelerates, and also as those women who are rapidly surpassing men in educational attainment come of age, I think that they're going to have to take leadership roles.
Why have men, do you think, been hit so hard by this recession? I know you talk about how globalization has already been bleeding the job market for men. Why the recession on top of that?
Well, I think that the recession is really just accelerating lots of trends that already existed. One way of looking at this is if you look at African-American men, for example, there's a big gap between them and women in terms of educational outcomes. It's even sharper than it is for the general population. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One reason is you have higher incarceration rates, et cetera. And, you know, the end result is that women oftentimes have a hard time finding men to marry, men who are of similar social status to themselves who can help raising children. And, you know, some people argue that this set of problems got really bad in the late 70s and early 1980s, because that was a time when the labor market position of less skilled men started to really rapidly deteriorate. And so, you know, you saw the emergence of a black-white unemployment gap. You know, now that gap is something on the order of, you know, for white men, the unemployment rate is about half what it is for black men. Now, we think of that as something that's always been true, but it hasn't always been true. It's only been true for the last, you know, 25 years. And so the question is that actually going to end up getting worse? Is this going to actually accelerate that trend? Because, you know, because we have a disability system, for example, lots of men who see that, you know, I'm not likely to do well in the labor market might actually choose to take that option. Or you also have lots of men who would have a hard time, who would really be struggling in the labor market, who are actually behind bars. So it's a really disturbing portrait in a lot of ways, and that there are no parallels with women.
Well, and one of the things that makes it more complicated is you talk about how men are more likely to have sort of psychological problems adjusting to not having a job, or for the change in power dynamic between men and women changing, and that these men could become a social problem.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of people have objected to the article on the grounds that women actually face incredibly difficult circumstances, and they're absolutely right. Women do face a tough time, particularly globally. I mean, when you're looking at the developing world, it's women who are sustaining their families. And so, you know, when women suffer economically, children suffer economically as well. And in the United States, you know, clearly there's a lot of room to be made up in terms of real women's equality. But at the same time, women are a lot more resilient. And one thing that you've seen happen as women have entered the workforce in large numbers is that there has been this move toward greater flexibility. And so, you know, the male breadwinner model of being in the workforce in a kind of one continuous sweep doesn't really apply to lots of women who are mothers. Those are women who actually need more flexible schedules. They need to be more resilient by nature so they can go in and out of the workforce. They can work longer hours at certain times and fewer hours at others. And I think that, you know, men have to adapt to those new circumstances. They've had a very difficult time doing it. So it's that casualization of labor that I think a lot of people see as a pernicious thing that, you know, women have just been better suited to. And I think that you see that in a lot of interesting ways in lots of different countries and contexts.
But what is kind of the nightmare scenario is that you have a huge portion of the population, at least in America, of unemployed young men who aren't married, who are just kind of sitting around drinking and causing disorder?
Yeah, I think that's basically right. I think if you look at China, for example, they have a huge, huge problem with surplus males. That is, they have a lot more men than women, particularly in younger generations. And that problem is probably going to get worse before it gets better. And, you know, what happens to these men who aren't going to be able to find partners to start their own families, and particularly if they have a tough time finding work, as manufacturing declines in China, just as it's declined in the United States, they might turn to networked, coordinated violence. You know, they might turn to crime on a mass scale. But then also, like, you know, let's leave aside those kind of really crazy outcomes. I mean, when you're looking at the employment situation in the United States, there is this sense in which the number of so-called non-employed, people who are just not attached to the workforce, might actually keep steadily increasing over the next 10, 20 years. And so maybe they won't turn to crime or anything dramatic like that, but it means their lives are going to be full of despair. They're not really going to be connected to the economic mainstream. And that's going to mean that they're not going to be able to raise families. They're not going to be able to do a lot of the things that we think of as the basics of being a citizen. And that's pretty scary stuff.
And the other option, I suppose, is that men adapt and they start entering professions which might fare better as we come out of the recession, healthcare and education, or they might choose to form more equal partnerships. Is that the adaptation side of things something that you see just as likely?
Yeah, I think that that is already happening to lots of men at both ends of the income scale. You know, you certainly see that with upper middle class men. They tend to take more pride in their identities as fathers rather than just their identities as salaried professionals. And I think that when you're looking at working class men as well, they actually do tend to take on more of the childcare burden than is conventionally believed. So I think that those are basically positive signs. But I have to say, I mean, I think that as I look at the new unemployment numbers, I just worry that we're heading into a buzzsaw, that we're heading into a real structural shift in the way the economy works. And when you ask people where are the jobs going to come from in the future after we go through this large-scale displacement, people talk about green jobs, but they don't talk about much else. And I'm an optimist, basically. I think that, you know, we're going to get out of this somehow, and I think that we're going to have some kind of flourishing economy, provided we remain a, you know, free enterprise economy. But I also think that there are no easy answers, and I think that we're pursuing policies that are so wrongheaded that I think they're going to make matters worse before they make them better.
Explain a little bit what you mean about how you've looked at the unemployment figures and you think we're heading into a time where the economy is just not going to work the same way. You called it a buzzsaw era or something like that. What do you mean by that, and why? And what's the effect on men versus women?
I just wrote a column today for Forbes.com, and it was all about just how when you're looking at the unemployment rate, it's actually much higher than you'd expect it to be given the amount of GDP decline that we've had. And, you know, part of the worry is that some of the policies that we've been pursuing, you know, that are very good in terms of their intentions are actually creating work disincentives so that people are actually less inclined to make more money in the kind of mainstream marketplace rather than in the underground economy. And I think that, you know, if you have these policies in place, not just as a temporary measure, but, you know, over the very long term, for example, I'm not someone who hates taxes. You know, I pay my taxes. I happily pay them. I think the IRS probably should get more money so they can enforce the tax code more effectively. But I think that when you start increasing marginal tax rates too much, it definitely discourages work. Now, when you're looking at a poor African-American man who is, say, you know, let's say he was recently released from prison on some kind of trumped-up charge, and, you know, he's trying to get back into the workforce, and, you know, he's already facing very low wages in the mainstream economy. But then, let's say he also has a kid, and for very good reasons, we've gotten more and more aggressive about child support enforcement. But that also means that if he gets a legitimate job, then his wages are going to be garnished. So that amounts to a very high marginal tax. And that means that it actually might make more sense for him to work off the books than to work on the books. And, you know, ironically, that actually makes matters worse, because if he had more incentive to work in the mainstream economy, he could actually start providing for his children, and he could start getting pension benefits, he could take part in Social Security and a wide variety of other things. Now, this stuff applies much more directly to those vulnerable men than it does to women, because, again, women haven't been screw-ups in the same way that a lot of men have been, a lot of men who've kind of had a tough time adapting to the new economy. That's an unkind way of putting it, but I think that, you know, women just have been better at making it through and sucking it up and and working.
Well, what evidence do you see then? You mentioned one there, but that women are going to be the beneficiaries of these cultural and economic changes instead of it just hitting men and being something that, because they're a big part of the labor force, why are women going to come out on the greener side?
Well, I'll give you a kind of a funny way of looking at this. Actually, you know, you could say that women, because they have high rates of educational attainment, they're going to take more leadership roles. They're going to be working in larger numbers. Their labor force participation rate is actually going to increase. But actually, they're not really going to be beneficiaries, because that means they're going to actually have to take up a lot of the burden of making the economy work. That's not to say that men are the beneficiaries either, but it's just a situation in which, you know, it's not obvious that it's going to be hunky-dory when, you know, you no longer are able to share the burden equally with, say, your husband. You know, let's say your husband is actually, as you were saying earlier on the couch and just drinking himself into a stupor. Then, you know, if you want to see to it that your family is on a decent footing, can maintain a middle-class standard of life, you're going to actually have to work much harder than you would have had both partners been participating equally. So there are definitely, you know, some downsides imaginable to this world. But on the other hand, as Stephanie Kuhn's wonderful feminist historian pointed out to me, you could say the same for men. I mean, for all this time, men have had to take up that burden rather than, you know, spend more time with their families. So maybe it's just desserts. But, I mean, it's by no means a situation where, you know, women or men should be breaking out the champagne.
But on the other hand, as women gain more of that power, social, economic, political power, I don't see how you can call that a bad thing.
Well, I think that, look, I think that it's a good thing because I think that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, women have a tremendous amount of talent that has been underutilized by societies. And I think that, you know, if you look at Iran, for example, women have been doing extremely well there in educational terms, but they're excluded from the upper echelons of the economy. And that's one reason why you had tremendous unrest in Iran. You had women who were on the streets rioting to see to it that the candidate they saw as friendlier to their interests would come to power. And so I think that, you know, you see this across the world, this real demand for women to get an equal share of power, and I think it's a very good thing. But, you know, I don't think that we can be, you know, glib about it. You know what I mean? It's not like, you know, it's not going to be an easy situation for anyone to adjust to.
Okay, we need to take a quick break right now, and then we'll come back and continue our conversation with Rehan Salam. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the article we're talking about today called The Death of Macho. It appears in July's Foreign Policy magazine. And we'd love to get you in on this conversation, too, at 1-800-642-1234. And tell us whether you think Americans are tired of financial policies that favor men. Do you see the same shift that our guest sees coming up down the road, that women will have more of the power and men forced into either a more equal partnership or maybe having some social problems dealing with the changes? What do you see happening and how do you think it's going to play out at 1-800-642-1234? Our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock today, join us for Talk of the Nation. Talk long enough about the problems with healthcare in this country, and someone will mention Canada. After 1 o'clock on Talk of the Nation, what's so great about Canada's healthcare system, and what isn't? I'm Veronica Rickert, glad to be with you this morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about an article that appears in this month's Foreign Policy magazine. It's called The Death of Macho. Our guest this morning wrote it. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation. And we'll go ahead and start taking your phone calls now. We've got Tricia joining us from Madison. Hi, Tricia.
Well, I was thinking when you first started the show that part of this comes from the fact that we're not losing as many traditionally feminine jobs. Where we're losing a lot of male jobs in manufacturing and stuff, where you're still having high demand in hospitals and teaching. The nursing definitely has still high demands. I'm going into the nursing field, and I was studying the nursing shortage, and you're actually seeing a lack in nursing shortage with the slowdown in the economy, and I just wanted to hear your guys' comments, and I can take them off the air.
Okay, thank you. And Rehan Salam?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. In fact, you know, this is one of the most striking things that's been going on. When you're looking at the job losses that have happened, they've been heavily concentrated in construction and heavy manufacturing. And those are areas that have been a huge, huge part of male employment in the United States. When you're talking about the decline of the housing boom, it actually is this really, really big deal with lots of complicated ripple effects. One of them is when you're looking at housing construction, which is now ground pretty much to a halt, that was a way to give to provide good-paying jobs to men who hadn't always finished high school, for example, men who've really been battered for the last 30 years for a lot of complicated reasons. And so when that goes away completely, you see people who had been making, say, $800 a week see that fall to zero. And so that's definitely, you know, a huge, huge thing, whereas you have a lot of women who work as home health attendants, they work as registered nurses, they work as teachers, they work in sectors that are financed by the public sector. And though the public sector is retrenching to some degree in the states, you know, by virtue of, you know, collapse in revenues, it's not contracting nearly as much, partly because you have stimulus dollars flowing to the federal government, which has been borrowing massively to kind of prop up that sector. So I think that that's definitely a big driver of this in the short term.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call, Tricia. And on to Rick in Mellon, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Oh, hello. My degree is in economics, so I have a primarily economic analysis here. I agree with practically everything the guest has said, you know, from a cultural standpoint. And I think in the United States, this has been exacerbated by affirmative action, not only at the government level, but also by many private companies who have been copying this practice. But what I really wanted to talk about is the proximate cause of the economic decline we have right now, which in my opinion goes back to policies of the Clintons. I'll try to make this brief. Number one, the Clintons went and pushed that through that regimen of trade agreements called NAFTA, which have created an enormous economic imbalance between the United States and principally China. Then number two, the Clintons abolished the Glass-Steagall Act, which was enacted by Franklin Roosevelt to prevent this sort of predatory behavior on Wall Street from infecting the commercial banking system. The Clintons repealed that law. And then, thirdly, the Clintons also put through a law, I think it was called the Commodities Trading Reorganization Act or some such, which completely deregulated very risky investments like derivatives. And I think that now we're suffering the consequences of some of these very ill-advised laws. And then there's one more thing here. I'm an independent, so let me just say what I believe the Republicans are responsible for, and that is allowing these big Wall Street firms like Goldman Sachs to privately politic the head of the Fed to drop the reserve fractional requirements required for commercial banking by the Fed. You know, that's a 12-to-1 ratio. I don't want to make this too complicated. But when Goldman Sachs had to be bailed out by the Feds, they were up to a 24-to-1 ratio. In other words, they were twice as risky as a standard commercial American bank. And that other one, Bear Stearns, is up to 33-to-1. In other words, they were engaging in primarily risky speculative activities, not really commercial banking. And this was all allowed by the enormous political influence these big banks have, not only with the Clintons, but also with the Bush administration. And there's an idea for a guest here. There was one young woman with a really funny name, something like Berkeley Born, if I'm pronouncing it close to right, who's a securities lawyer, from, I believe, from California. She tried to get Chairman Greenspan and the others involved in this tight little group to not void these banking regulations for these huge international banks, and she got shot down. You should get her on the program.
Okay, thank you, Rick. And what about the topic today about whether this is hitting men harder than women?
Well, sure. And it's primarily because of what the Clintons did with this these NAFTA agreements. That's just a regimen. There was a whole bunch of trade agreements under that that rigmarole. And they all had the effect of exporting high-paid, high-benefit, male jobs overseas, primarily to China, but also to other countries. And the one bright hope here is that the capitalist economy will start to reverse this when the price of gas gets up to $5 or $6 a gallon.
And what do you think about the points Rick is making there? I mean, he goes and tries to get at the roots of it, but one thing he talked about at the end there was globalization and why that's hurt so much, too.
Yeah, I've got to say I'm pretty strongly pro-globalization. Although, I mean, it's kind of like saying you're pro-clouds because, you know, I think that globalization is this extremely powerful, sweeping phenomenon that manifests itself in a lot of different and complicated ways. I think that the caller made a lot of interesting points. I wouldn't agree with all of them. I would agree with some of them. With regard to the Clintons, I think that NAFTA actually didn't have such dramatic consequences for the United States. It did have very dramatic consequences for Mexico because basically our tariffs against Mexican goods were already very, very low, and the same for Canadian goods. It was actually Canada and Mexico that had to go through a pretty wrenching transition. And when you're looking at Mexico, if you look at the maquiladoras, if you look at the various transplant factories south of the border, a lot of that work has actually been displaced. A lot of that has gone to China, where they have, you know, lower wage costs, but then they also have, you know, these tremendous economies of scale by virtue of having these very, very big manufacturing agglomerations. So there are a lot of reasons, but I thought that actually something really intriguing at the end about energy prices and about how that actually might lead to some kind of shift. And, you know, maybe it could. I mean, if energy prices are high enough, shift some manufacturing activity back to the United States. But the real structural thing is you're seeing manufacturing jobs vanishing not only in the United States, but also in China. In fact, China is losing far more manufacturing jobs in the United States in absolute terms.
Why is that?
That's because it's the same reason why you have so few people working in agriculture. You know, if you look at the United States 200 years ago, you know, you had the vast majority of the population working in agriculture, and now we're feeding far more people, but we're feeding far more people with a tiny fraction of the population, something like, you know, 2% mm-hmm. of the population, because the agricultural sector is just much, much more productive and efficient than it was before. Similarly, it just takes far fewer people to build automobiles, to make computers, to build things like infrastructure than it took in the past. At the same time, I think that, you know, we've allowed our infrastructure to decay to such an extraordinary degree that, you know, we clearly need people dedicated to revitalizing it. That's very expensive, but I imagine that's something that we're going to have to do over the next, you know, 20, 30 years. But I think that the decline in manufacturing, it really isn't something we can blame on another country. Not that that's what the caller was doing, but it's just a real structural thing that's driven by a very good thing, namely advances in technology. But the question is, where are those new jobs going to come from? And I think that we're always surprised by that. If you look at the dominance of the service sector today, you wouldn't necessarily have predicted that in the 1950s. Or, you know, in the late 18th century, lawyers and doctors were not prominent people. Those were incredibly dangerous professions. There was no credentials. There was no formal training for those jobs. They weren't seen as respectable jobs. And I think it's easy to imagine, you know, jobs that we don't think of as very desirable jobs today becoming very desirable in the future.
Well, thank you for the call, Rick. And another call now from Michael in Whitefish Bay. Hi, Michael.
Oh, good morning.
Morning.
I'm an elderly physician. In my class of my medical school class of 1958, there were two women in a class of 96 at the same school. This year, 2008, there were 56 women in the same size class. I'd like your guest to comment.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
Out of how many graduates?
Oh, we just lost him.
Oh, that's okay. If you look at veterinarians, you have a really interesting phenomenon where you used to have only a tiny number of female veterinarians, and now the overwhelming majority of people who graduate from veterinary school are women. When you're looking at physicians, you see this move in the direction of more female physicians, and there are a lot of complicated drivers for this. For example, you don't see many as many women going into medical specialties as men, but you see lots of women becoming primary care physicians. And primary care physicians are compensated less than specialists. And so, you know, it's an open question, why is that the case? Well, it could be that women are gravitating toward aspects of the medical profession that are salaried, that allow you to have more stable hours so that it's more compatible with raising a family. But, yeah, overall, I mean, when you have a situation where men are dropping out in huge numbers, when women are getting the BAs, inevitably they're also going to be getting the postgraduate instruction. But even then, it actually manifests itself in funny ways where women, you know, aren't doing the things that are going to always maximize their income. So it's a complicated picture.
Well, on the other hand, you have a lot of people talking these days about how college degrees are getting sort of gutted of meaning. And you could see a scenario in which the college degree lost its prominence, maybe even grad school advanced degrees losing prominence, and there being some sort of shift that would devalue that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the reason why, college education is still very valuable relative to, you know, only having some college or high school. But you're right that it's the premium is going to decline as more people acquire college education. So what's interesting is actually that the premium has remained as robust as it has. What's interesting about that is that you'd think that when there's this big wage premium that you'd see far more people going to college. But you don't have that, and you still have huge numbers of men who are dropping out. So, I mean, that's actually a real puzzle for us to figure out as a society. You can imagine a scenario in which, for example, we turn toward other forms of credentialing. When Abraham Lincoln became a lawyer, he actually never went to law school. He just took the bar exam. He just was an apprentice. He studied for a long time and just took the test. And one could argue that that was actually a much better way of organizing our economy. Because it doesn't have these similarly, you know, very high barriers to entry that you have right now. So it maybe, you know, it's a situation where men just aren't flourishing in school because, you know, the kind of discipline that going to school requires doesn't suit them. But, you know, that's actually a big problem because when you look at people with GEDs versus people with high school diplomas, people with high school diplomas do much better economically than people with GEDs, despite the fact that the GED suggests that, you know, those folks are, you know, certainly smart enough to finish high school.
Right.
And the reason is that the high school diploma tells an employer this person is capable of waking up at 7 a.m. and showing up to work on time and sticking it out. It's a non-cognitive skill. It doesn't have to do with your raw brain power, but it has to do with how reliable you're likely to be. And so, you know, if you have women who are finishing college, finishing postgraduate education, it's a clear sign that they're able to defer gratification and that they're able to make a kind of long-term investment in their future. And that's a signal to employers.
Right. It is now. But as you say, maybe, you know, that could shift the power back to men again if we decide that instead of going to law school, you just have to take the bar exam.
In theory, if, you know, men ended up being sort of patient enough to actually do that work. But again, it goes back to, you know, it's not just demonstrating that you kind of have the basic knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's also demonstrating that you have stick-to-itiveness. And that's the thing that men seem to lack versus women.
Another call now. We've got Carol joining us from Plymouth. Hi, Carol.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm not sure if you covered this, but one of my questions was the birth numbers affecting women's availability right now. In other words, are we having more or less births? Are births down because women need to work and the whole issue of that, of birthing? Secondly, the percentage of women who are voting in our country versus arbitrarily 10 or 20 years ago. I believe it's increasing, but how is it affecting the total attitudes in the elections and stuff? Also, the increase of women in the numbers of women in colleges, and if anyone knows why that's happening, and also the ages of women able to spend time in political discourse, in other words, that they are older and maybe don't have children right at home, and that they're able to spend more time to deal with these issues. So that's enough.
There's a lot there. Yeah, I think that, let's see. With regard to that, I think actually a lot of your questions are tightly connected to the first one about female employment and the birth rate. So I'm going to focus on that one, if that's okay. One really interesting and surprising phenomenon is that it is countries in which women have high rates of labor force participation, in which high numbers of women are working, that actually are having the higher birth rates. So, for example, in Southern Europe, in Italy and Spain, those are countries where you still have traditional gender roles in which women with children are discouraged from taking part in the workplace. And that has actually led to a situation where women are having very, very few children, which is funny because, again, those are kind of Catholic countries. We think of them as countries that have a huge emphasis on family and that also, you know, tend to have lots of children. That's absolutely not true now. Italy is right where Germany is in terms of an extremely, extremely low birth rate, that is going to lead to dramatic decreases in the Italian population over time, which will be balanced to some extent out by immigration. Whereas in the United States and in Northern Europe, countries like Sweden, those are countries in which women participate in the labor force at very high rates, and also those are countries that have relatively high birth rates, the United States more so than in Northern Europe, but in both cases they're certainly higher than in Southern Europe. And so one argument for this is that it has to do with opportunity costs. That means that, you know, if you can still work while you have children, that means that the economic cost of raising children is actually not that high as it would be if you couldn't work at all. Because if you couldn't work at all, then your opportunity cost is quite enormous. The opportunity cost, you know, meaning that, if I weren't doing this activity, I could be making X amount of money. And that could be any number of things. That could be raising a kid. That could be entering a convent. That could be, you know, all kinds of stuff that's not taking part in the mainstream labor market. And so, you know, the issue is, how are we combining raising a family with employment in the market economy? And, you know, in Europe, they do it very differently from the way that we do it here. There, they use very high taxes to finance child care provision that is subsidized by the public. In the United States, we have this different way of doing it, which is a lot of women, middle-class and upper-middle-class women in particular, rely on immigrant women who are, you know, much poorer and who are coming from other countries. Say they're coming from the Caribbean, they're coming from Mexico, in order to look after children at lower cost. And so it's interesting because our immigration policies are very tightly tied to the rise of labor force participation by college-educated women. With regard to the political stuff, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, in the U.S., as in many countries, you know, you have the situation where the difference in birth rates varies across educational groups. Massachusetts is the first state in the United States where the majority of children are born to women over the age of 30 rather than under the age of 30. That's a very, very big deal. And also, mothers tend to be somewhat more educated in Massachusetts, and also their marriages tend to be somewhat more stable. Whereas if you're looking at working-class women and poor women, they're far more likely to have children out of wedlock, and they're also likely to have somewhat more children than upper-middle-class women. And that is an interesting thing when it comes to the future of the country and the future of our labor force, because, you know, you have lots of older people who have, you know, very high credentials who are leaving the labor force, and yet a lot of the younger people who are coming in have unique problems that are associated with growing up in a household in which English is not the first language, or in a household where you didn't have the supervision that you get from having two parents in the home. And that's a very, very big, deep issue for the future of the country.
To leave it there for the moment and take our next break as we talk with Raihan Salam, fellow at the New America Foundation and author of the article we're discussing today called The Death of Macho. It's running right now in July's Foreign Policy magazine. And of course, we welcome your calls this hour too at 1-800-642-1234. Do you see a backlash against men, especially in the wake of the current recession? And how do you see this playing out down the road? 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in This Week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next on Wisconsin Public Radio, Larry Mueller is in and he's talking with UW-Green Bay historian Kim Nielsen about the life of Anne Sullivan Macy. She was Helen Keller's teacher and the subject of Nielsen's new book. It's called Beyond the Miracle Worker. That's Larry Mueller coming up at 11 o'clock. Veronica Rickert with you this week. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn on Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about the article called The Death of Macho. It's running now in July's Foreign Policy magazine. We're talking with its author, Raihan Salam. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation, talking about how the recession, sometimes called the he-cession, has impacted men and what's coming up down the road in terms of jobs for men, the economy, and women's role in the economy that emerges after the recession. And we'll go back to the telephone lines now. Mike joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi. It's my impression, and I want to see if you agree with this or not, that young men are testosterone-driven, young women are estrogen-driven. This is a reproduction thing. If it wasn't that way, we wouldn't reproduce. And so consequently, young kids, they're males, they tend to like to roughhouse it, and they're running around all the time and, you know, causing a lot of grief for the parents. women, not totally, but on the average, are much more inclined to do sedentary tasks, like academic tasks, for instance. And so you get to college, and which is, we're turning it into vocational school, I guess. What happens is that the boys lose interest, and the girls go through and get their degrees and get the nursing job or whatever it is thereafter, pharmacy or whatever. So what happens then is that if they're going to produce children, then the male stays home. It's called role reversal. My friends who do this, and I have quite a few that have done this, are not totally happy with this situation at all. And so I think my question then, if I have to phrase a question, is can we really engineer a biological imperative? Can we change the behavior of yin-yang, which they knew about 5,000 years ago?
Well, you know, I think we already have. If you look at the birth control pill, it has transformed the face of the world in really dramatic ways that we haven't even fully thought through. And so, you know, you have seen radical changes to human behavior already with advances in science that, you know, are now about 50 years old. So it's interesting to think through what are the next bevy of advances that are going to further transform gender relations. But one thing I would also note is that when you're talking about how men are testosterone-driven and women are estrogen-driven, there's actually a lot of heterogeneity, particularly among women. For example, there are some who argue that when you're looking at women, the thing to focus on is the heterogeneity among them. So, for example, I mean, you know, this is stuff that I don't put a huge amount of stock into, but there are varying rates of testosterone across different groups of women. That also seems to condition the risk-taking behavior and just general aggressiveness of women. But then separate from that phenomenon, there's a sociologist named Catherine Hakim who's written about how across the industrialized world, you have four different groups of women in terms of their attachment to the labor market versus their attachment to the non-market household economy. You have one group of women who are almost exclusively devoted to market labor, you know, to the working world. You have another group of women at the other end who are almost exclusively devoted to family life and household labor. And then you have a group in the middle who can go either way, depending on what kind of tax policies you have. And so, you know, the question is, what is the best mix of policies? And different countries have settled on different answers to that. And I think that in this country, we're still figuring that out.
Well, thank you for the call, Mike. And another call here from Charlotte in Glendale. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi. My question is this: as how do we teach our children? You know, I think that your book, the title, just answers the question. I mean, how do you teach a child when they're older? You know, like a little girl, when your husband is not working, you're going to have to take care of him. It's almost like, you know, it's not natural or something. You know, I mean, it happens. I mean, we have it in everyone's family, but it doesn't seem natural. And then I think about women in power, for example, Oprah, they don't reproduce. A lot of them don't. They don't marry. So it's like they are totally, you know, giving up on men. They're just waiting for them to, you know, die out or something. I don't know.
Boy, this is really, really interesting stuff. I mean, I think it's true that traditionally you've seen lots of women who take on leadership roles, make big sacrifices, or sometimes it's just not something that they're terribly interested in. But I think that as we go forward, I think that, you know, and the societies that are going to succeed are the ones that allow women to both have a fulfilling family life as well as take part in the economy. And it's also going to allow men to do the same thing. But with regard to what to teach children, I mean, that's a tough question to answer. I would, you know, my own personal view, and I don't have a ton of evidence to back this up, but is that I think that it's important for women to demand more from men. And when you demand more from them, you get more from them. I think that, you know, you could argue that the big problem over the last 30, 40 years is that actually people stopped expecting great things from men, or they stopped expecting not even great things, but even just, you know, basically, you know, we're not going to enter into a serious relationship unless you do X, Y, and Z, for example. And I think that that has been really pernicious. But again, that's my, you know, personal view, and it's hard for me to say, you know, that that's my command to the public.
I want to end here with a quote from your article, which struck me as being pretty dramatic and provocative. You say, as women start to gain more of the social, economic, and political power they have long been denied, it will be nothing less than a full-scale revolution, the likes of which human civilization has never experienced. We've got about a minute here for your answer, but tell us a little bit about why we're talking about a revolution. And when you say what we've never experienced, what do you see as coming down the pipeline?
I think that we don't know what a society is going to look like in which women have an equal share of the power, because women have almost never had an equal share of the power. If you look at a country like Iran, that country is going to be rocked to its foundations when women decide that they're not going to accept, a role as second-class citizens. And I think that's going to be true in China. It's going to be true in India. It's going to be true, all over the world. So I guess that's my way of saying that we don't know what it's going to look like, but my hope is that it's going to look much better than what we have right now.
So you think ultimately this is not going to shake us to – it will shake us to the core, but it will be a positive outcome for men and women.
Well, I think that's what I hope. But again, if men decide that they're not going to play ball and that they're going to violently resist this new set of circumstances, then it could be really ugly.
Well, Rehan Salon, thank you so much for your time. It's a fascinating article. It was great to talk with you about it.
Thanks for having me.
Rehan Salon is a fellow at the New American Foundation and author of Death of Macho. That's the article he wrote, which appears in July's Foreign Policy magazine. A thank you to Rachel Owens for answering your phone call and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. If you'd like a copy of this program, you can call the radio store 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program 727E. I'm Veronica Rickert, happy to be with you this Monday morning. I'm in all this week for Kathleen Dunn. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.